Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, Jay Fox will interview an expert about healthcare for veterans. Jay will also chat with a woman who formed a company to help military spouses earn additional income. And he'll talk with someone about romance scams that target seniors. Plus, Doug Petcash from Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective.
It is estimated that there are over 95,000 veterans here in Franklin County and more than 150 veteran service organizations. The Department of Veterans Affairs is accelerating the deployment of its federal electronic health record system. This transformation and the accompanying modernization of the technologies that connect to it will support delivery of veteran health care into the future. VA Deputy Secretary, the Honorable Dr. Paul Lawrence, joins us now on Columbus Perspective to discuss the importance of this new system and its impacts for our veterans. Welcome, sir.
Hey, thanks, Jay. Thanks for your interest in veterans, and thanks for giving me the opportunity to talk about the steps we're taking to improve that experience with us.
It's our pleasure to have you. Let's start at the beginning. What exactly is the Federal Electronic Health Record, or EHR?
Right. It's a tool for our providers, our doctors and nurses, that has all of veterans' information, all the charts, all the records. It's connected to a secure internet portal so that elsewhere, if you're not in the VA, if you go to a private provider, they can see your information. And it gives us a chance to have lifetime information about the veterans so you don't have to repeat your history over and over again when you go see our doctors. So we think it's going to make the veterans' experience with our hospital when they come for care so much better.
So it's kind of like my chart for veterans, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, you can log on, renew a prescription, make an appointment, message your doctor, and the information will transfer if we send you into a specialist out in the community.
So when are we getting this?
In Columbus, you actually already have it. We put it into the Columbus facility in 2022, but in Chillicothe, Cincinnati, and Dayton, it'll be rolling out in June of this year. So we're very excited to announce that in about 120 days, Ohio veterans will pretty much have it almost anywhere they go.
Now, what is the difference between the old system and what's going to be the new system?
Yeah, well, our old system was antiquated. It was built about 30 years ago, and technology and the way medicine is now in software is just different. So the new stuff, quite frankly, like so much of life, is better. It allows, you know, the records to be everywhere veterans to go. They don't have to carry paper anymore. If they winter in Florida and live in Columbus, your records will be there. So quite frankly, it's just more powerful, and it makes it just easier for us to do things like update and provide new technology in the future as artificial intelligence comes along and there are new ways doctors practice medicine. This will allow us to have it and use it for our veterans.
Does this new system incorporate both physical as well as mental health care?
Oh, yes. All care that you get at the VA will be on this, right? We do interesting things with prosthetics and social workers and, you know, a whole range of things. So it'll all be there.
What about the possibility of, you know, transportation and unique service needs?
That's right. Well, we work closely with nonprofits and the like to make sure our veterans can get to our facilities. But what's really interesting about what we're doing now is we're trying to make sure we have a network of providers that are close to veterans. So we call that community care. So we're trying to enrich that network to make sure we can be as close to as many veterans as possible.
How difficult is it to compile data for those who may still be alive who served in, let's say, the Vietnam War, the Korean War, or perhaps even the small few that are still alive that served in World War II?
Yeah, well, hopefully, if they've kept their records, we can generally find them. We have access to a lot of the official places. However, in 1973, there was a fire in our big facility in St. Louis that keeps all these records. So when someone shows up and their records were in that fire, we have to do extra forensics on that, which is why we always tell folks, so if there's some more recent veterans, please make sure you have your records. That's the key to getting assistance from the VA. Did you serve? What happened to you? Stuff like that really makes it easier for us.
Now, will this allow VA physicians to communicate with physicians outside the VA system?
Absolutely. We know this happens all the time, and we need to be able to do that, right? Your records transfer, doctors can communicate with VA doctors and the like, so there's no doubt what the veteran needs and how that care can be provided.
As part of your job as the deputy secretary, what is the biggest issue facing veterans in terms of health care right now?
Well, I think it is access, quite frankly, right? There's about 17 million veterans in the United States, I think 17.5 million. About 9 million of them use our system, so we want to make sure all veterans who would like to get health care from VA understand that. As you pointed out, where locations are, if you live in rural parts of the country, like medicine in general, is often hard to find a provider. And quite frankly, across the country, to include veterans, demand for mental health assistance has increased as we better understand it, and the number of mental health providers in our country is there's a shortage of them. So those are the kind of issues that keep us going. But we're very proud, for example, that about 120,000 medical professionals in the United States are in our system getting training. So we're very proud that the work we do is so good that doctors and nurses come here to get trained.
Now, this applies to people who are also currently in the service now, correct?
Yes. The Department of War, Department of Defense, has a version of this. So they're using it's a little bit different, their own system. But what's really great about it is when you leave the military and become a veteran, your information will transfer. So when you come to the VA, we will have the history of what happened to you while you were in the service.
So let's say you re-enlist and you're deployed to a foreign country. Will that allow you to take that information with you over there?
Yes. So the Department of War's record is such that it travels with them, sort of like what we're talking about. But just to kind of continue our example, and if you're exposed in your deployment and you come to VA, we will understand where you were, what happened to you, and what that means in terms of the care and the benefits we can provide you.
That's fantastic. So for those veterans who are listening today, and there are always quite a few of them, where can they go to learn more information and figure out what's right for them?
Certainly. Well, you can find a lot of information about our new electronic health record at our website, va.gov, and just search electronic health record or EHRM, and they'll see a lot of information about what's going on, when the schedule will be in their neighborhood, and some of the puts and takes. But quite frankly, this ought not be that big a deal for veterans. It's sort of behind-the-scenes stuff, but they should be aware of what's going on because it'll give them more access to interact with us.
All right. We want to thank the Honorable Dr. Paul Lawrence, the VA Deputy Secretary, for being with us. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
Columbus is home to the Defense Supply Center and numerous National Guard units. Statewide, it is estimated that as many as 40,000 military personnel live here in the Buckeye State. But military life is fluid, and transfers can happen at a moment's notice, disrupting family life for these folks. It could mean job loss for trailing spouses, loss of friends, new schools, and much more. After facing that cycle herself, Lisa Bradley created R. Riveter, a nationwide home-based network where military spouses can sew and assemble products from wherever the military sends them. And she joins us now on Columbus Perspective to talk about her company and how it's helping to solve the problem. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, thank you so much for telling your story today. And you're right, I've moved a total of 14 times. So that was the reason why we started this company, is to be able to help other military spouses that are in the same position.
Why is it so hard for military spouses to find stable work?
Well, I think that it's quite a few things. You know, the multiple moves, move on average every 2 to 3 years. But then when you know, now that I've been on the other side of it, being also an employer, I also see the difficulties of hiring someone that is just going to leave. And you really see that reflected in each military spouse's resume because it's so fragmented from all the different jobs that we have. So it's really important to be able to find something that you can plug into remote.
What makes flexible or home-based work so important for families who move this often?
You know, it's being able to have that type of consistency in your life. And so we really wanted to create a different work from home opportunity that didn't really exist back in 2011 when we started the company. And so we created a distributed manufacturing line. So we send the parts and pieces. A lot of times it's the liners of our handbags out to military spouses. They're able to sew them from home. And then one of the most unique parts is that they're actually stamping their maker stamp on it. So you can go to our website and you can read about each military spouse that goes into making each and every one of our handbags.
So our Riveter obviously is a nod to Rosie the Riveter from the World War II public relations campaign. What inspired you about that story to lead you to this story?
Right. We're so proud of our husbands for their service to our country. And the military spouses and Rosie the Riveters, who weren't necessarily all military spouses during that time period, they weren't just standing on the sidelines. They were jumping in and helping our country when we really needed her the most. And when you really think about it, they really helped us win that war. Most of the planes and ammunition during that time period were actually all built by women. And so we really wanted to carry that torch forward, that we want to be part of our American economy and not just complain about it. You know, one thing after another, not being able to find work. Enough is enough. Let's create a job where we can help other military spouses also plug into the economy and support our country in a really unique way.
Now, 15 years ago, when you started this business, were you here in Columbus or were you elsewhere?
You know, I grew up in Montana. I didn't know much about what it was going to be a military spouse. And so this first couple of years, the military really refers to families, spouses, and children as dependents. And I thought that's a strange word to refer to family members. But move after move, I really did start to feel dependent. And so what we're really trying to do is create dignity and being able to have something for themselves, an income for the family, and be able to support their families in other and unique ways.
So did you start this in Montana?
No, I grew up in Montana, and then I moved to Columbus, Georgia, actually.
Oh, okay.
It was actually and then ended up here. And so I'm lived in 3 of the 14 Columbuses across the country.
Wow. So how long have you been in Columbus, Ohio?
I've been here for 9 years.
And do you anticipate that being permanent, or is another transition on the way?
No, I think this is finally it. You know, being able to put down roots for our family has been really important, and we love it here. The people are so arms wide open, and one of the best places we've ever been in those 14 moves. So we've really enjoyed staying here.
To what degree has this particular business assisted in positive mental health support for the military spouses, whether they be male or female, who are the trailing spouse in the situation?
I think moving is frequently, as military spouses do, there's a lot of identity loss that goes into that. You know, new community, new friends, new support system. And so being able to have something consistent really helps with that mental health of moving as frequently as we do. And that really helps with retention in the military. If the spouse is able to find something consistent and be able to be a little bit more, you know, happy with the life that they're living, then it also helps the military member go overseas and do what they need to do without worrying as much about their family at home.
What does the finished product look like? Walk me through that.
Yeah, so we make canvas and leather handbags. A lot of them are reflected off of the early years when we made everything out of recycled military materials. So now we make it out of a wash canvas. And so it's really a reflection of the durability of the military materials. And then we use full grain leather. And so you can see a product that is very reminiscent of the roots that it came from. We actually have other lines, a limited edition line, which is actually made out of recycled military materials, and then an heirloom line where you can actually send in your uniform and we can make a custom product out of it. So you really have that ability to bridge the generations. If you have a family member that was in the military and their items are just sitting in a closet somewhere, you're able to send it in and have 5 to 6 handbags made out of it, which make really great gifts that really just connect families and keep those military stories at the forefront.
Now, is this just just for people in the military, or can the general public buy these products?
No, yeah, absolutely. Anyone that is proud to be an American and really believes in supporting our nation's military can buy our products and are very, very proud to carry them. Each one comes with a yellow support tag, which is a throwback to the ribbons around oak trees that they used to put to be able to support our military members. And so that everyone really carries that with a lot of pride.
Now I have the Tony Orlando song from the 70s playing in my head. Thanks for that earworm. Is it a store or is it strictly online?
Yeah, we actually have a store here in the Columbus area. It's outside of Granville, Ohio, and it's in a store called Cedar and Thread. So you can actually come in and see the products in person. But then you can also go to our website at ourriveter.com and review all of our handbags, all the different collections, and also, more importantly, read all the military spouses that are behind each and every one of these handbags.
So explain to me what the 5% give back program is and how does it impact military families?
Yeah, so we give back 5% to be able to help other military spouses start their own business. We really feel that entrepreneurship is the ultimate flexibility of being able to work when they need to between running three shifts. You know, sometimes they are their parents, their spouses, and then we know that they're remote riveters is what we call them that plug into our distributed manufacturing line. And they are also able to grow and create their own product-based businesses through this program. So we give out two grants a year of $2,100 each. That's how much we needed when we started this company in an attic back in 2011. And we want to prevent other military spouses from having to put their first inventory on a credit card like we did. So we find it really important to help support other military spouses that want to launch and grow their own product-based business. And you can actually read and shop on our website for some of those products today.
What's next for Lisa Bradley and R. Riveter?
You know, just continuing to help military spouses. We've just launched a affiliate program so that military spouses can make 20% on anything that they're able to sell through their network. And we are excited to be able to help a different way for military spouses to be able to plug in. So we're really excited about that program.
All right. Well, we want to thank Lisa Bradley from R. Riveter for being our guest this morning. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on the Fan. Here's more from Jay Fox.
Here in Columbus, there are over 100,000 senior citizens, and it's a rapidly growing population demographic for our city. Sadly, many of these individuals fall victim to online scams, especially when it comes to matters of the heart. Amy Nofziger is the Senior Director of Victim Support with the AARP Fraud Watch Network, and she joins us now on Columbus Perspective to discuss how romance scams unfold and why reporting them remains low and what steps people can take to better protect themselves online. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
What are the most common patterns you see in these romance scams today?
So what we're seeing today is that a lot of these romance scams are actually starting as kind of friendship scams. They might not start right at romance. So perhaps you're on a social media group for people who like classic cars, and you're discussing it, and all of a sudden you have a message from someone who's like, hey, I really liked your point about that. And you have this conversation. And after a couple of days or weeks, then it turns into romance. So I want people just to be aware that a lot of these scams are starting innocently as friendship scams. Another trend that we're seeing is that these friends or these romantic interests are actually encouraging their targets to then invest in cryptocurrency. So they might say, oh, you know, I retired early because my cousin is a crypto trader. He can teach you as well. You know, go to this platform and he can mentor you. And then finally, one of the trends that we're seeing, and this is just the devastating trend of this, is that people are losing more money than ever. We had a victim just last week that lost $400,000 in one of these scams. And it's not just the money that is being lost, it's the hopes and dreams that these criminals create for their targets that is lost as well.
Well, when you think about scams, you think about people calling on the phone, people sending you an email perhaps, or, you know, my favorite one is the one where, you know, click here because, you know, you've won $1 million, and somebody always falls victim to that. But when you think about romance and you think about forming relationships, that's built on trust. So how are mainstream platforms like Facebook and X and TikTok, how do they play a role in all of this?
Well, they certainly play a role, because when we did our recent research, we found that the majority of victims say they met their scammer on a traditional dating app or traditional social media. The majority of people met them there. So if you're meeting someone on a dating site or social media, assume that the scammer is already in the room, waiting to target you. And that's not to scare you. That's really to empower you to have your defenses up so you can protect yourself.
Well, how do you know? I mean, what are some of the red flags that people should be aware of? And then we'll talk about what they should do if they suspect somebody.
Yeah, so some of the red flags are the criminal will want to get you off of that platform quickly. So they'll want to take you to an encrypted texting app like WhatsApp, Telegram, Signal, some place where they can't really be watched. They will also shower you with love and affection. And who doesn't want to be showered with that kind of those words, right? But that's what will get you in, under the emotional ether. Then they'll start creating some crisis, like, oh, honey, my car broke down. I can't get to work. I just need $250 and a prepaid gift card. But what I like to say to people is, at that first gut feeling, when you first feel it in your gut that something might not be right, trust your gut, not that profile picture or not what that person is saying.
Well, and it's also very likely that that profile picture and the name are completely fictitious.
They're absolutely false. And that's something that you can actually do, is you can take that profile picture and you can put it into a Google image search and see if that picture is being used anywhere else. That's just one of the things that you can do to protect yourself.
So let's say that you have your suspicions about someone. Do you cease contact? Do you get law enforcement involved? Is there, you know, do you contact the AARP? Where do we go from here?
Yeah, how about all of the above, right?
Okay.
First, stop communication immediately. And then report that profile to the platform that you're on and let them do some investigation. If you have lost money or personal information or were encouraged to trade in crypto, report it to law enforcement immediately. We always recommend people start local, so report it to local law enforcement. Also, you can report it to the FBI. And certainly, if this is all too overwhelming and you don't know where to turn, call us on the helpline. And I'll give that number. It's 877-908-3360. And then we can help guide you on where to report it.
Part of the problem is that people who experience being victimized are embarrassed, and they don't want to tell anybody what happened to them, and they certainly don't want to report any financial losses. And it really impacts the aging community, because, you know, that could be a sign that maybe, you know, mom is not as sharp as she once was, and maybe she needs a different type of care. What other reasons would there be for victims not wanting to report such a crime?
In our society, we blame the victims of these financial crimes, but they were a victim of a crime and someone stole from them. So we really need to encourage them to report. And in our research, we found that more than half of victims never reported the crime. And honestly, shame keeps people silent, And the silence protects the scammer. How are we going to go after them if we don't know it's happening? So if anybody in your life has told you that they've been a victim of this crime, go with them and support them to report it.
I have heard from people that they don't want to report because they fear some kind of retribution from the person that's trying to scam them. So is there a way that that reporting could be safer and maybe, you know, more privately accessible rather than having to be so public?
Certainly, you know, law enforcement is going to protect and keep you safe from any of these criminals. And if you ever fear harm from them, you know, of course, call your law enforcement immediately. But what we're really encouraging a lot of the dating sites and social media sites to do is have in-app reporting. So at the first gut feeling that something is off, you can just press one simple button and report that profile. Then we're asking the platforms to review that report within a few days and certainly immediately remove that profile from their platform, and then even warn other users that maybe they've been talking to a criminal.
What happens to the money? So let's say I've been scammed, like that poor person who was scammed out of 400 grand. Are they getting that money back, or is it just a loss?
You know, law enforcement is doing everything they can within their power to trace where these funds go and get money back for victims. But the problem is, again, reporting is so low that we really need to encourage the reporting and the reporting quickly. So if you are a victim and you realize it, report it as soon as possible to law enforcement and give them any information that you have about this criminal so then they can do their job.
So Casanova123 is probably a bad profile to click on.
I think that is a good thing. Yeah, I would not click on that.
All right. We want to thank Amy Nofziger from AARP for being with us today and for Columbus Perspective. I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV.
My guest today had a unique seat for a two-decade ride through Ohio and American history alongside a man known for making quite a bit of history himself, some of it out of this world. Dale Butland served in several roles with Ohio U.S. Senator John Glenn, and now he's telling that story in this brand new book. More on that in just a minute. But first, here in Columbus, John Glenn is immortalized at the John Glenn Columbus International Airport and the John Glenn College of Public Affairs at Ohio State. At one time, he was likely one of the most famous people on planet Earth after he left planet Earth for 5 hours on February 20th, 1962. One of the original Mercury 7 astronauts, he was the first man to orbit the Earth. Glenn was also a 23-year veteran of the U.S. Marine Corps who was a fighter pilot in World War II and the Korean War. He was a test pilot, businessman, and a four-term U.S. senator representing Ohio. And that's where Dale Butland comes into the story. Senator Glenn hired Butland as a speechwriter in 1980. Butland went on to serve in several capacities for the senator over the next two decades: press secretary, campaign director for Senator Glenn's final reelection campaign in 1992, and as the senator's Ohio chief of staff. Now, Dale Butland has put down his memories of his time with Senator Glenn in this new book, When Ohio Was Blue: My 20-Year Journey with John Glenn. It covers the period from 1980 until Glenn's retirement from the Senate in 1988 and beyond. A friendship that endured until Senator Glenn's death in 2016 at the age of 95. It's being published by the University of Akron Press and comes out in 2 days, March 3rd. Now, you may recognize Dale Butland from his many appearances here on Face the State as a Democratic strategist and analyst. He joins me this time, though, as an author. Dale, congratulations on the new book.
Thank you, Doug. Appreciate it.
So why did you write this book now?
I actually wrote it for several reasons. Number one, I have some grandkids now. In fact, my wife and I have 11 grandchildren now, which may be proof positive that we need to start negotiations with the Planned Parenthood Association. But anyway, I wanted my grandkids to know what their grandfather did for a living and why he devoted a good portion of his life to this, to public service, that is. And if I can you know, I want not just my grandchildren, I want all children and grandchildren to understand in this country that politics is not a dirty word. It's not a spectator sport. It's something that we all have to get involved in. We all have to take part in. And if I can move the needle just a little bit in that regard, it will have been well worth writing.
And what do you want people to take away from this book? And, you know, their impressions of what you did and what Senator John Glenn was and did.
Well, there's a lot of anecdotes and stories in this book, as you know. In fact, the first two-thirds of the book are mostly anecdotes and stories, though mostly stories and anecdotes with a point to them, I hope, not just stories for the sake of stories. But then the last third of the book, I talk a little bit about how we got to where we are in this country in terms of politics and maybe some reform ideas for how we might get out. But I do think that it's important that, you know, look, what we have right now is not sustainable. We have Democrats and Republicans who are at each other's throats all the time. And I'm not just talking about in Washington. I mean in our cities, our streets, in our homes, our families. It's as though Democrats and Republicans live on two different planets. It's as though we don't even share the same reality or the same facts. Well, that's not sustainable in this, in our democracy. So I'd like us to get back to a place where it used to be back in the 1980s when John Glenn was active and even beyond that. But we need to get back to some semblance of civility in our politics.
So you went to work for him as a speechwriter first in 1980. Yeah. I guess how intimidating was that, first of all, and then what was the experience like?
Yeah, well, it was very intimidating because John Glenn, as you pointed out in the intro, was one of the most famous people on the planet Earth, particularly back then, because his orbital flight was not that old at that point. You know, he did it in 1962. So it was intimidating, and it was. You know, John Glenn had acquired a reputation for being a dull and boring speaker. When he was at the 1976 Democratic Convention, gave the keynote address, he gave a policy-heavy speech that just didn't work very well, and he was labeled dull and boring. And now I was the dull and boring guy speechwriter. While I was very flattered to have the job, and I was very proud to have been hired, I've always said it was a little bit like being boxing promoter Don King's barber. It was a little embarrassing to tell anyone, you know. So, but I think that John got better as we went along. I certainly tried my best, and he started getting better reviews on his speeches.
He certainly did. And you worked for both Senator John Glenn and Senator Howard Metzenbaum, and you write that for them, politics was not a blood sport. Compromise was not a moral failing. Is that, do you think, what defined their politics and their governing style?
Yeah. I mean, you know, Howard, and by the way, I work for Howard. I was on loan from John Glenn to Howard Metzenbaum for 9 months for Howard's last campaign for reelection. But yeah, it's hard to describe, particularly for younger people who may not have known politics before 2016, when things, this is kind of with this anything goes kind of politics that we have now. Back then, Democrats and Republicans argued over policy things. We argued over what policy was best to bring down inflation or to put people back to work. Nobody argued over whether to accept an election result or not. That's relatively recent. And that's why I say politics for John Glenn and Howard Metzenbaum and all those people like them back then, politics was not war. Your opponents were not enemies. Winning an election was not viewed as a license to grift. And losing an election was not evidence that it was lost or stolen. And as you said before, compromise was not a dirty word. They recognized that compromise is the lifeblood of a democracy. It's the only way it can work if you have a competitive two-party system. We need to get back to that kind of politics.
You described Senator Glenn as the most open-minded politician you ever worked for.
Yeah.
How so?
John Glenn had a quality about him that you don't see a lot today, I think, in politicians, that he had a genuine sense of humility. There was, he believed that he might not always be right, might not always have all the answers, and that he would genuinely benefit from hearing other points of view. So he asked for that all the time. And in my case, for example, he was always willing to hear me out if we had a if we had a different view on a policy issue. I didn't always win the argument, of course, mm-hmm. but he always let me get my oar in. Always let me make the case. And that's really all that you can expect if you're a staffer.
And a big example of that is the debate over the flag-burning amendment
yeah.
that was happening in the mid-1990s. And you talk about his process of making that decision, because you're talking about a Democratic senator, but also this is an issue of, you know, burning a flag that he represented as a fighter pilot, as an astronaut, as a senator, as a veteran who loves his country, but that is also the free speech aspect of it. How did he approach that decision and what he ultimately did?
Yeah, so John's first reaction was visceral. He was for the flag burning amendment because he deplored flag burners. As I told him, I don't have any brief for flag burners either. Even when I was in college and I was an ardent opponent of the Vietnam War, I never thought burning a flag was an appropriate way to express your dissent. But the Supreme Court ruled with Antonin Scalia, mm-hmm. who is a conservative icon, voting with the majority, voted that burning a flag in protest was a constitutional right. What I talked to John about, and I recount the conversation in some detail in this book, we talked about the fact that that while everything that is inappropriate should not necessarily be illegal. And the truth of the matter is, we need a First Amendment. And the flag symbolizes all the freedoms we have under the First Amendment, freedom of speech, freedom of protest, and so on. What a hollow victory it would be if we protected the symbol of our freedoms by chipping away at the actual freedoms that that flag represents.
And that's the end. That ended up being the side he fell on.
That's right.
When you're high, you feel different. You think different, you talk different, you draw different, you listen to music different, but you probably knew that. Problem is, you also drive different, and not in a good way. That's why driving high is illegal everywhere. So if you're high, just don't drive. Make a plan to get a sober ride. Because if you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Dangers rarely lie out in the open, so no matter where you live, it's important to know harmful pests can hide in and around your home.
Here I come!
Rodents and cockroaches are drawn to food waste and garbage.
I know you're out here.
Ticks lurk in tall grasses, and mosquitoes lay eggs in standing water.
I can hear you.
Rodents, ticks, and mosquitoes can all spread dangerous diseases.
I gotcha.
Seek the facts you need at pestworld.org. A public service message from the National Pest Management Association.
I have to get to the story. He did his orbital flight in 1962.
Yeah.
Didn't get a chance to go back into space
right.
until 1998.
Right.
Or, yeah. How important was that to him at the age of 77 to be able to go back into space aboard Space Shuttle Discovery? And you were there for the launch, too.
I was. It was very important to him because all the astronauts had been promised two flights. John only got one. And it wasn't until years later that he found out the reason he only got one was because President Kennedy thought that was very wary of sending John up for another flight because he was maybe the most famous man in the world in the face of our space program in this race to the moon with the Soviet Union during the Cold War. And he thought if something were to happen to John, it would be a public relations disaster. So he grounded John quietly through NASA. John found that out years later, but he was determined to get that second flight. So when he went, and they were doing research at that time on the effects of aging, mm-hmm. Or the effects of space travel on aging. John was 77 at the time. So he went, and he was up in space this time for 9 days. But you know, when you're in weightlessness for an extended period of time, there's all sorts of changes that start to occur within the body.
Mm-hmm.
And I won't go through them all, but to make a long story short, many astronauts have a hard time walking when they exit the craft. So NASA was certain that at John's age, he was going to need a wheelchair, right?
Yeah.
So they had one waiting for him outside the capsule when they landed. John told me later, he walked off the shuttle, and he told me later, he said, you know, I knew everybody in the world would be watching, and I was determined to walk off that craft, even if it killed me. And I won't lie to you, it was hard, but I gritted my teeth and I did it. Doug, I think that's what they call the right stuff.
Yeah, and I mean, that was kind of his character, wasn't it? I mean, he understood his role in history and the way he was viewed, and it was the real person, but he lived up to that.
Yeah, he always felt a responsibility. He always felt a moral responsibility. He knew he was a national hero. I think he is one of the few astronauts who did not cash in on that. He never did an ad for anything, not beer.
Tang?
Tang. None of that. John felt that that was crossing the line. And he was unfailingly polite. I think I told you before, off camera, that when we would have dinner places, you know, we're going between campaign events or whatever, his dinner was interrupted constantly with people coming over asking for photographs or for him to sign things. He never refused, always did it. Even though his meal was getting cold, he would sign the thing or he'd get the picture because he felt he had a responsibility. I wish more people felt that way these days.
Dale Butland, the new book, When Ohio Was Blue, My 20-Year Journey with John Glenn. It's a good read, folks. I read the whole book myself. Very fascinating stuff. Dale is, congratulations.
And it makes a lovely St. Patrick's Day gift.
A St. Patrick's Day gift. Thanks for being on the show again, and congratulations.
Thank you, John.
On the book.
Appreciate it.
Dale, thank you.
Again, that's courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV. From the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. Heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM The Fan 2.